And part of the connection to this is based upon this principle. Israel, the Torah, and the God of Israel are Ahad. They're one. Israel, the Torah, and the God of Israel are Ahad. They're one. Who's the God of Israel? It's Yeshua. So Yeshua, Israel, and the Torah are one. How can they be one? Because at Mount Sinai there was a marriage. Yeshua married the house of Jacob, and the terms of the marriage was following his Torah. So they're one. So because they're one, when you're in marriage, what happens to one happens to the other. Because you're one. So, you know, what one suffers, the other suffers. What one is has joy about, the other has joy about. What one does affects the other. What happens to one spouse affects the other spouse. So, we got the principle that what happens to Israel happens to the Messiah. But what happens to the Messiah happens to Israel. Because they're Ahad. So, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a debate about Isaiah chapter 53 when you share Isaiah chapter 53 with the modern Jewish people. And so, Christians like to go to the Jewish people and say, see, Isaiah 53 clearly talks about the Messiah. Don't you see that this is a prophecy about the Messiah? It says in verse 1, who has believed our report, and to whom is the arm of Yahweh revealed? He will grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has nor form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. He's despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquitted with grief. Surely he's borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. So they say, see there, that's talking about the Messiah. So is that talking about the Messiah? The answer is yes. But some of the Jewish people argue that that's not talking about the Messiah, that's talking about the nation of Israel. That the nation of Israel is the suffering servant. And so they say, the nation of Israel, they say the Jewish people is the suffering servant, that's not talking about the Messiah. So Christians say that's talking about the Messiah, that's not talking about Israel. So even though if you really see in the Jewish writings, the Jewish writings do refer to Isaiah 53. Even the Talmud refers to Isaiah 53 and says it's talking about the Messiah. But if you don't know what the Jewish writings say, an Orthodox Jew will come to you and say, well, Isaiah 53 is not talking about the Messiah, and you don't know any different. You don't know that he's not really telling you the whole truth, the full truth, and nothing but the truth. He's only telling you what he wants you to believe. So the question is Isaiah 53 talking about the Messiah, or is it talking about the nation of Israel? The answer is both, because what happens to one happens to the other. So we have Daniel's 70-week prophecy that the 70-week prophecy is a prophecy about the people, but it's also a prophecy about the Messiah. And it's a prophecy about the first coming, but it's also a prophecy about the second coming. And so now I'm done covering the principle that time is according to the duration of the exile of Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom. And that, at least for the Northern Kingdom, we presented to you that the time of the exile is over. What about the Southern Kingdom? The Southern Kingdom is a little bit more complicated, and that's what I need to finish explaining to you. But in finishing explaining it to you, we come to answering the question about how do we know if we're the final generation, meaning the generation that ends the 6 days and the generation that sees the inauguration of the seventh day. We're not talking about the world ceasing to exist. We have at least another 1,000 years till this present world is no more and we enter into eternity. So the world as we know it is not going to cease to exist. It's just being transformed into a new era. It's being transformed into the seventh day from the 6 working days. And so the Almighty birthed in my heart, at least that I recognized, a desire to want to understand and study Bible prophecy and learn about the last generation and to be excited about the coming of the Messiah when I was 16 years of age. So that's about 37 years ago. And so in the last 37 years, you know, I've heard, like probably that you've heard, different ones saying, well, this is the year, this is the year. So that's all because they were trying to figure out when does the final generation start and how long is it? And the evangelical perspective is it's associated with the birth of the modern day state of Israel. I'm going to have to agree with that. The question then is how long is the generation? Because taking the words of Yeshua and Matthew in chapter 24, he said in verse 32, now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is nigh. Then he says in verse 34, this generation will not pass till all these things be fulfilled. So they say the fig tree is Israel. Israel was born in 1948. Yeshua promised that the generation would not pass. So this is the final generation, but how long is a generation? So, you know, when I was 16, 18, 20 years of age, I initially listened to Bible prophecy teachings by Jack Van Impe. He's still on television, been on for a long time. And in those days, he was saying that a generation was 35 years from 1948. And so he said that, believing in a pre-trib rapture, he says the rapture should happen about 1983. So what was his basis for a generation is 35 years? Well, it's from the book of Job. It's from the book of Job. And if we go to Job, the last chapter, chapter 42, and it says in verse 16, after this lived Job 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons, even 4 generations. He lived 140 years, 4 generations. So you take 140 divided by 4, and how long is a generation? 35 years. So from this verse, you take 1948 plus 35, that's the generation. Yeshua promised this generation would not pass. So therefore, the end of this generation is 1983. Didn't happen. Then we can go to Psalm. Let's go to Psalm 95. Speaking of the children of Israel in the wilderness, Psalm 95, verses 9 and 10. Your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my work. 40 years long was I grieved with this generation. How long is a generation in the wilderness? 40 years. So therefore you have 1948 plus 40. That means the end of the generation is 1988. You remember the book, 88 Reasons Why Messiah is going to Return in 88? That's because the generation was 40 years. So there isn't a one answer in the Bible regarding how long a generation is. So that's why someone could say it's 35, someone could say it's 40. But then, around the approaching of the year 2000, Jack Van Impe was teaching in Matthew in chapter 1, verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David unto the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations. And from the carrying away into Babylon unto Messiah are 14 generations. So he said, The average length of a generation here, go back and look, review it, he said was 51 point whatever years. So you take 1948 plus 51 point whatever, you got the generation ends at 2000. So he's trying to take a verse that talks about the generation and try to figure out how long is the generation. So the test of it being 35 years from Israel being a nation? No. 40? No. 51 point whatever? No. So now we have a chance to do another test. And from my perspective, the longest the generation is in the Bible, from my perspective and understanding, is 70 years. And this is based upon Psalm in chapter 90 in verse 10. The days of our years are 70. The days of our years. That means how long do you live? You live 70 years. Well, your life is a generation. So it's 70 years. So now, from 1948, 70 years, you're looking at 2017, 2018. So now we have a test coming up of that generation of being 70 years. Are we now at the time? It wasn't 1983, it wasn't 1988, it wasn't 2000. Is this the one? Well, let me give you a Hebraic perspective of how it very well could be. And remember the principle that I shared with you in the last session, that biblical history is prophecy? Do you remember when the southern kingdom, the house of Judah, was punished for 70 years of captivity? That's a prophecy. That's a prophecy of Judah in the last generation that returns to the land. And so, let me show you something that Yahweh opened up my eyes to 3 months ago in January from Jeremiah chapter 29. And you have to pay attention to what you're reading in order to get it. All right? So now we're going to go to Jeremiah 29, verse 10. I'm going to show you how biblical history is prophecy. It says, "Thus says Yahweh, after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place." So what's visiting them, and what's his good word, and what's returning to this place? It's the end of the exile. You're returning to this place, the end of the exile. So he said, after that 70 years of Babylonian captivity, I'm going to end your exile. Well, did Ezra and Nehemiah come back after 70 years? So that prophecy was fulfilled in part in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, but only a remnant returned. The exile itself of the southern kingdom did not end. Let's keep on reading. Verse 11. And this is a verse that's often quoted and plastered, that's probably taken out of context. "I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says Yahweh, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end." Now, pay close attention to the next few verses, because the subject is after 70 years of Babylonian captivity. That's the subject. It says, "Then you will call upon me and go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart, and I will be found of you." You're going to seek for me and you're going to find me. I will be found of you. What's the context of those words? After 70 years of Babylonian captivity, you're going to seek me and find me, and I will be found of you. You're going to seek me and search for me, and I will be found of you. Who's me? It's Yeshua. The promise is after 70 years of Babylonian captivity, they're going to seek for the Messiah, and the Messiah is going to be found of them, and the Messiah is going to reveal himself to them. Not only is Messiah going to reveal himself to them, but look at verse 14. I will be found of you, says Yahweh. I will turn away your captivity. I'm going to gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I've driven you, says Yahweh. I'm going to bring you again to this place which I caused you to be carried away captive. Do you realize that when they were taken into Babylon, they weren't in all the nations? They were in one nation. This says after 70 years of Babylonian captivity, I'm going to bring you back from all the nations. That's a worldwide captivity, which wasn't the case after 70 years of Babylonian captivity. But he says after 70 years, you're going to seek for the Messiah. The Messiah is going to reveal himself to you and your exile will end. Well, what is the end of the exile and the revealing and the coming of the Messiah? When does that happen? That happens after 6 days. That happens at the beginning of the seventh day. So this is language referring to the last generation. And how long is he saying there's going to be a captivity in the last generation? For 70 years. And so that 70 years is going to be associated with the prophecy of Daniel in chapter 9. Because with the help of Brad Scott, and I called him one day, and he's a good Hebrew linguist. He understands the Hebrew language and the Hebrew grammar. And where it says 70 weeks, the word weeks is Shavuim. And so the root of Shavuim is Shavua, and Shavua means the seven. So this is how they get its 70 sevens, or 70 times seven. But Shavuim is a male plural ending. The female plural ending is Shavuot, which is the name for Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks. Shavuot. This is in the male plural form, Shavuim. So why is it in the male plural form? Brad explained it to me. Because if there were 70 people here, and among the 70 people are males and females, you refer to the collective unit in the male plural. So the collective unit is Shavuim. So therefore, from the Hebrew grammar, that Shavuim can be a collective unit. A collective unit means one. So I could translate that as 70 times one. I could also translate it as 70 times seven. The Hebrew is such a way, it can be both. So when they say it's 70 times 7, they're correct. If they say it's 70 times 1, I believe it's also correct. So it's 70 times 7 as it relates to the first coming, but it's 70 times 1 as it relates to the second coming. So this is 70, and you could read it, well, it's the male plural of Shavua, Shavuim, but the female plural is Shavuot. So your unit of measure can be the counting of the Feast of Shavuot. So what do you do between Passover and Shavuot? You're counting. And so here you would be counting 70 Shavuot. And so after 70 Shavuot, he's going to do these things. In other words, after 70 years, he's going to do these things. So Daniel 9 is connected to Jeremiah 29 that after 70 years, or after 70 Shavuot, Messiah is going to reveal himself to his people and the exile is going to end. And so, if you kind of go back to Jeremiah 29 and regard the 70-year Babylonian captivity as the subject, and what he says about the subject is, Messiah is going to reveal himself when you seek him and find him, and you're going to end your exile. If you still regard that that is the subject, and when you get to this number 30 in your Bible, when you get to 30, it causes you to think, well, new thought, because number 29 is back here, and number 30 is over here. New thought, so you forgot about what was said in 29, and you're thinking, when Jeremiah wrote his scroll, he didn't put 29 and 30 in there. He continued writing. So if you continue the thought of Jeremiah 29 after 70 years of Babylonian captivity. In the chapter 30, he talks about it being Jacob's trouble. If you continue the thought, after 70 years of Babylonian captivity is Jacob's trouble. So that must mean, if we're in the final generations and that 70 years pertains to this generation, that must mean that Israel today is in Babylonian captivity. Today, right now, this second, this moment. So, would most people think that Israel today is in Babylonian captivity? No, because the Jews have left their exile and they're living back in the land. So that's the return. That's called Aliyah. That's the return to the land. And when you return to the land, you're not regarded as being into exile. But are they in a Babylonian captivity today in the land? The answer, in my opinion, is yes. How's the answer yes? And who's the Babylonian entity they're in captivity to? Well, let me tell you something that I did not know about until 2009, is that the details about how the modern-day state of Israel was born. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, declared the independence of the state of Israel on May the 14th, 1948. In the natural, why did he declare the state of Israel on May the 14th, 1948? Why didn't he do it on May the 13th? Why didn't he do it on May the 15th? Why didn't he do it on May the 10th? Why didn't he do it on May the 20th? Why May the 14th? It's because following World War I, with the defeat of the Turks and the Germans by the Allies, Britain got control over the Middle East area in what was known as the British Mandate. And so ultimately, from World War I, there was a Jewish chemist by the name of Chaim Weizmann who helped and made a major contributions to help Britain and the United States defeat the Germans. And so he asked as a political favor that the British government would work to establish a homeland for the Jewish people. That's called the Balfour Declaration. And so, while the British pursued that promise, at the same time, they tried to do what's being done today. They tried to appease the Jews in that promise, but they also tried to appease the Arabs. Well, when they tried to appease both sides, guess what? It didn't work. Just like it's not working now. So the Jews fought against the Arabs fought against the Jews. And so this happened over 30 years, and when the King David Hotel got blew up, I forget, was 46 or 47, the British says, we give up trying, you know, this is too complicated. We're going to give the matter over to the United Nations. So the United Nations, through the General Assembly, voted on a solution to the problem. And on November the 29th, 1947, they voted to have a solution to the problem. And they voted to have a two-state solution and to share Jerusalem. They voted that there be a Jewish state, that there be an Arab state, and Jerusalem would belong to nobody. It would be an international city. That was the vote, November 29th, 1947. It got passed in the General Assembly. And that vote was to be implemented at the end of the designation of the British Mandate. And so they established a date for the end of the British Mandate, and the date that they established was May the 14th, 1948. That was the day designated to be the end of the British Mandate and British control, and from that moment, the matter was in the hands of the United Nations. The British gave it over to the United Nations. And so, when David Ben-Gurion declared the independence of the State of Israel on May the 14th, 1948, he was saying, we accept the General Assembly vote where they said that there would be a Jewish state. We want that Jewish state, so we declare that Jewish state on the day of the end of the British Mandate. And the President of the United States, Harry Truman, recognized it. And so when David Ben-Gurion established the State of Israel, he did so by agreeing to the UN vote. By agreeing to the UN vote, he in essence made a covenant with the United Nations. The modern day State of Israel came into existence by them making a covenant with the United Nations. So why does the international community today insist that there's no other solution but the Tuesday solution? Because they are embracers of the role of the UN in our world. And if they say that there is any other solution but the two-state solution, they're saying that the UN General Assembly vote of 1947 has no relevance. And if it has no relevance, how they got to try to convince the governments of the world to join together into a one-world government under international law when they're rejecting a ruling of international law? And so they don't want to do away, they want to empower the rulings of international law. So that's why they insist there's no solution but a two-state solution, and there must be a sharing of Jerusalem. And the news just in the last few weeks, Putin of Russia said, "We, Russia, want to recognize that West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and East Jerusalem is the capital of the Palestinian state." Israel said, "We have to think about this for a moment." But the modern-day state of Israel is in a Babylonian captivity. Who's the Babylonian entity? The United Nations. What's Babylon mean? It means a mixture of cultures and peoples. What's the United Nations? It's a mixture of culture and peoples. So the United Nations is your modern Babylonian entity. And so Israel is in a Babylonian captivity. How long were they in a Babylonian captivity? For 70 years. How long will they be in a Babylonian captivity? For 70 years. So when did the captivity start? Well, when they agreed to the covenant, but the covenant was inaugurated on November 29th, 1947. So what are you counting to see when's the end of the time? You're counting Shavuot. So from November 29th, 1947, or from May the 14th, 1948, till today, to this moment, which is April the 29th, 2017, how many Shavuot have we been? 69. So Shavuot of 2017 will be the 70th Shavuot, the end of the 70 weeks. And so the prophecy and having a multi-layered understanding in Daniel 9, it says, "He will establish a covenant with many for 1 week." So if 70 weeks is 70 years, 1 week is 1 year. And so this UN nation resolution of December the 23rd, 2016, you know, written in the resolution, they declared a desire of when they wanted to see a final status agreement and a solution to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And you know, on the December 23rd, 2016 resolution, you know what time designation was on there? 1 year. So even though they're not really thinking in their minds that ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is intended to be in 1 year, and after 1 year they've got to give up on it. That's not what they're thinking. But if you read literally what they wrote, they said that this is to be completed in 1 year. So they set an end point to it, 1 year. So they set an end point. That means the covenant can be over now after 70 years. So now you become the issue of when does the year begin, and what's the meaning of after 70 years? What does after 70 years mean? So in practical terms, does after 70 years means we get to the 70th Shavuot, which is the Shavuot of this year? So does after 70 mean between Shavuot of 2017 and Shavuot 2018? Is that after 70? Or does after 70 means you have to get to the 71st? So is that Shavuot 2018 to Shavuot 2019? And then after 70, how do you start the new year? Is it in the spring? So does that mean you have to wait until the Great Tribulation starts after the 70, but then at the beginning of the year, which is in the spring, which would be Passover 2018? Or is it in the fall? Or is it after the 70 Shavuot, which is 2017 or 2018? Then is it the spring or the fall? So there can be the way you see the timing. You could say, well, we're at the end of 70 years, but you could be wrong if you don't make the right count even within this 1 to 2 year period. But it appears to me like we're coming to the end of the 70. Now, I'm going to show you in Jeremiah chapter 25 how this is written. In Jeremiah 25, verse 12, it says, "It will come to pass when 70 years are accomplished that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, says Yahweh their Elohim, in the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it, the land of Babylon, a perpetual desolation." Now, what does it mean to make it a perpetual desolation? Now, remember, we're Hebraic, biblical history is prophecy, and it's in part, but not in its fullness. So, after 70 years, did the kingdom of Babylon, that was under King Nebuchadnezzar, did that kingdom under him in the Babylonian Empire, did it cease to exist? And if it ceased to exist, did it become a perpetual desolation if it ceased to exist? The answer would have to be yes. What happened after 70 years? Cyrus, the king of Persia, came and defeated the Babylonian captivity, and there's never been a Babylonian empire after Cyrus, the king of Persia, came and defeated the Babylonian kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, so therefore it became a perpetual desolation. But people still lived there, so it wasn't a perpetual desolation that people quit living there. So was that the fulfillment of the prophecy, or is the fulfillment of the prophecy later? The answer is yes. It was a fulfillment of the prophecy, but not the fulfillment, but the fullness of the fulfillment of the prophecy, because that which happened historically is prophetic of the future. So now there's a Babylon in the end of days that after 70 years of that captivity, that there's going to be a Babylon that's going to become a perpetual desolation. So now let's look at Isaiah in chapter 13, in verse 1, it says, "The burden of Babylon." Verse 6, "How for the day of Yahweh is at hand." This is a judgment upon a Babylon as we approach the day of Yahweh. And then it says in verse 19, "In Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans shall be as when God overthrows Sodom and Gomorrah." Verse 20, "It will never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation." It will never be inhabited. This is what's going to happen to Babylon as we approach the day of the Lord. It will never be inhabited. If it will never be inhabited, guess what it has become? It has become a perpetual desolation. And that is what the prophecy says. So now, we are going to look at Jeremiah in chapter 50. But before we go to Jeremiah 50, in Isaiah 13, where it says, there's going to be a judgment upon Babylon, it will be a perpetual desolation. In Isaiah 14, verse 1, it says, "But Yahweh will have mercy on Jacob and will choose Israel and set them in their own land, and strangers will be joined with them, and they will cleave to the house of Jacob." So as this Babylon is falling, Jacob is being redeemed. As Babylon is falling after 70 years, Jacob's being redeemed. So now we go to Jeremiah chapter 50. Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 3. This is a prophecy against Babylon, verse 1. Verse 3. "For out of the north there comes up against her a nation which shall make her land desolate and none will dwell therein." Now who's coming against Babylon is a nation. But now if we go to verse 9, it says, For lo, I will raise and cause up to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations. And they will set themselves against her, and she will be taken. So look, the one verse says a nation is going to come, and then a few verses later, an assembly of nations are going to come. Well, which one is it? Is it a nation or assembly of nations? The answer is yes. Because historically, it was a nation. And so that prophecy is written about what happened in the fall of the Babylon of King Nebuchadnezzar, but it's also written about a Babylon of the end of days. An assembly of nations will come against it. I believe that Babylon of the end of days is the United States of America. And so the fall of the spiritual land of Babylon. Remember, I just said the United Nations is a Babylonian entity. I said the United Nations is a Babylonian entity, and I'm saying the United States is a Babylonian entity. Which one is it? The United Nations or the United States? Yes. That was a beautiful reaction. I was given this message in Germany one time where I went over, now which one is it? Is it this or this? And the answer is yes. And there was like this autistic person that actually could hear. He could understand. He could communicate that well, at least in our English or German, I guess. And after I did this 5 or 6 times, he said, oh boy. So that's a good reaction. All right, and so now look what happens in Jeremiah chapter 50. It says in verse 19, And I will bring Israel again to his habitation and feed on Carmel and Bashan. His soul will be satisfied upon Mount Ephraim and Gilead. And in those days and at that time, says Yahweh, the iniquity of Israel will be sought for, and there will be none. The sins of Judah, and they will not be found, for I will pardon them whom I reserve. So now, with this judgment upon Babylon, Israel is going to return to his habitation, and their iniquity and their sins will not be found out. Their iniquity and their sins are forgiven. Because he's going to make a new covenant with them. So, was the new covenant when Yeshua died, or is the new covenant coming? The answer is yes. It was, but it will be. And so, therefore, what I'm trying to show you is the 70-year Babylonian captivity of the southern kingdom is prophetic of a 70-year last generation. And that covenant, or that 70 years, I believe, is associated with the covenant that the modern-day state of Israel made with the United Nations. And that made them... By entering in that covenant, they're not a free people. Can a Jew today live anywhere in the land of Israel that they want to live in freedom? No. They're being told you can't live in Judea Samaria. You can't live in Eastern Jerusalem. You can't live in the Gaza. And so they're in their land, but they're not free in their land. They're captive in their own land. Who are they captive to? This covenant that they made, this two-state solution is who they're in captivity to. They're in captivity to the Oslo Accords. They're in captivity to, okay, yeah, we're for a two-state solution. All right, so now we're coming to the end of that 70 years. And so what comes at the end of the 70 years? The prophecy that they're going to cry unto me, and I'm going to end their captivity. So there's a 70-year captivity, but the God of Israel is going to then declare the exile over at a certain point in time. He said, that's it. The exile's over. Well, what's the event by which he says, okay, the exile's over? It's Gog and Magog. So Gog and Magog is outlined in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And with the defeat of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 39, it says in Ezekiel 39, 25, Therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob. And have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and will be jealous for my name. So the God of Israel declares the exile over with the defeat of Gog and Magog. Now I'm going to bring back Jacob. So, as long as Israel is in covenant with the United Nations, he can't override that covenant. He's got to honor that covenant that his people made with the United Nations. He's got to wait till the covenant is over, till the 70 years is over. Then there can be a war, and then the Almighty can say, okay, it's up for negotiations now. Now I'm going to end the captivity. So I'm looking to see whether there's going to be a war in the land this fall. I'm looking to see whether there's going to be Gog and Magog this fall. If it doesn't happen this fall, maybe next fall. Maybe fall of 2018. Maybe fall of 2017. But we're watching and waiting to see, but it looks like that we're there. And the next thing I'm going to show you is based upon what I've been sharing with you, Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, where Yeshua said, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree." Now, all the farther that I've heard this explained is Israel's the fig tree. Israel's the fig tree, 1948, and so that's where you make the connection. I think there's an element of truth there, but I think it goes deeper. What is the parable of the fig tree? Let me show you what I think the parable of the fig tree is. See, a fig tree produces what? Figs. So I can also call this the parable of the figs, because a fig tree produces figs. So this is about the parable about figs. So do we have in the scripture a parable about figs? The answer is yes. It's in Jeremiah chapter 24. Jeremiah 24. And in Jeremiah 24, verse 1, it says, "Yahweh showed me two baskets of figs." Verse 2, "One basket had very good figs, like the figs that are first ripe. The other basket had very bad figs, which could not be eaten. They were so bad. Then Yahweh said to me, 'What do you see, Jeremiah?' And I said, 'Figs, the good figs very good, and the evil very evil, that can't even be eaten.' The word of Yahweh came to me saying, 'Thus says Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel, like these good figs, so will I acknowledge them that are carried away captive of Judah, whom I've sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans for good. I'm going to set my eyes upon them for good. I'm going to bring them to this land. I'm going to build them and not pull them down. I'm going to plant them and not pluck them up.'" What does it mean? I'm going to plant them and not pluck them up. That's the end of the exile. I'm going to bring them, not pluck them up. They're not going to go into exile anymore. So the good figs is the end of the exile. Then he says, continuing about the good figs, verse 7, "I'm going to give them a heart to know me, that I am Yahweh, and that they are my people, and I will be their Elohim, so they will return to me with all their heart." I'm going to give them a heart to know who? Who's me? Yeshua. So look, the good figs knows Yeshua, who he is, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And there's the end of the exile. That's the good figs. And now the bad figs. Verse 8, "And the evil figs which cannot be eaten, they are so evil." Verse 9, "I will deliver them to be removed unto all kingdoms of the earth for their hurt, to be a reproach, a proverb, a taunt, a curse, and all the place where I've driven them. And I'm going to send the sword, the famine, and the pestilence." I'm going to send the sword, the famine, the pestilence? What's that? That's the judgments of the Great Tribulation. That's Revelation judgments. So the evil figs gets the judgments of the Great Tribulation. The good figs gets to receive Messiah and see the end of the exile. And that's your basic outline as we come to the seventh day, the day of Yahweh. As we approach the day, it's a day of darkness and gloominess. That's the evil figs. It's a day of clouds and thick darkness. That's the good figs. And they're both happening at the same time. And so there's judgment for those who are not with Yahweh and His ways. And there's restoration and redemption and reconciliation for those who are with Yahweh and His ways. So look, it's judgment and restoration and forgiveness at the same time. What's that? That's Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is if you haven't repented, you get judgment. If you have repented, you get mercy. So it's Yom Kippur. What else is it? It's the Jubilee. What's the Jubilee? The Jubilee, we all have been told the, mostly the positive about the Jubilee is that you get everything returned. Yeah, that's true. But actually the Jubilee and about the Jubilee is not just Leviticus 25, but it goes into Leviticus 26. It says, if you're not keeping my commandments, then all these bad things are going to happen. So at the time of Jubilee, there's judgment if you're not keeping his commandments. There's restoration if you are. So therefore, the start of the day of Yahweh is a super Yom Kippur. It's a super Jubilee. And that's how the seventh day starts. So I'm going to give you a couple more verses here and I'll be finished. We go to Hosea chapter 5, verse 15. Hosea 5:15 says, I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early. So who's going to go and return to his place? Who? Yeshua. He, in Acts chapter 1, he went to return to his place. For how long? You'll not see me again till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of Yahweh. Till they acknowledge their offense. So when's he coming back? It says, Hosea 6:1, come, let us return to Yahweh. He has torn, that's the exile. He will heal us, that's the end of the exile. He is smitten, that's the judgments for breaking the covenant. And he will bind us up. He'll forgive us of our sins. After 2 days, he will revive us. After 2 days. After 2,000 years, he revives. So why are we being revived now? We even have a conference called Revive. Why are we being revived now? Because it's after 2 days. We're coming at the end of 2,000 years from Yeshua's first coming. And the third day, what's the third day? The third day is the start of the day of Yahweh. The third day is from his first coming, but it's the seventh day from creation. So the seventh day is also the third day. So in the third day, he will raise us up and we will live in his sight. What's raising us up? That's ending the exile. So the end of the exile is in the third day, which is also the seventh day from creation. So as we start the day of Yahweh, he's going to raise us up. And in that day also, we're going to live in his sight. How are we going to live in his sight? Because Yeshua is going to set his feet down the Mount of Olives and you'll be able to see him from Jerusalem teaching the Torah to all nations. He's going to raise us up and we're going to live in his sight. So that's God's prophetic time clock. There's the big picture from creation. The creation is a prophetic week. The earth labors for 6 days. It has Shabbat. And with in that big circle, there's a smaller circle that times according to the judgment for breaking the covenant at Mount Sinai, and then the end of the exile. The end of the exile is associated with the Sabbath, the Messianic times, the Messianic era, the coming of the Messiah. And so then we narrow it down to there's got to be a generation that makes that transition from the end of the sixth day to the beginning of the seventh day. And so when did that generation start and how long is it? Well, the generation, I believe, is from the covenant that the modern day state of Israel made with the United Nations, where they established themselves as a state. So how long are they got to be in that captivity? That's the length of the final generation. It's 70 years. So what happens at the end of those 70 years? You're going to have the judgment of the nations, and you're going to have the end of the exile and the coming of the Messiah. So that is the start of the seventh day, or the prophetic Sabbath of creation. And in creation, evening and morning was a day. So in the prophetic Sabbath of creation, the Messianic era, it's a day of darkness and gloominess. It's when he judges the nations. It's when Babylon falls. But it's also a day of clouds and thick darkness, which is Messiah revealing himself to his people, ending the exile of his people, and celebrating with them the end of that exile. Now, we want to be on the side of the good figs. We want to be on the side of being a part of Messiah's work to end the exile of his people and gather and unite his people and take them back to the land. So that's why what has come with this Hebraic roots restoration is the proclamation and the teaching and the understanding of not only return of the Torah, but there's two houses of Israel. And you need to understand who you are in Messiah through these two houses of Israel. That there's Jewish believers and there's non-Jewish believers, and they are a part of his family. They are the two houses of Israel. So there's a literal house of Jacob. There's a redeemed, saved house of Jacob. And that only if you return the Torah with all your heart are you going to understand that Messiah is coming to end the exile of his people. And the way that he's going to take his people back to the land is by the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And the understanding of how he's going to do that only comes by returning to the Torah, learning the Torah principles, learning the themes of Shabbat, learning the themes of the biblical festivals of Passover to Sukkot, and learning major Torah principles of biblical history as prophecy. That's the only way that you're going to have the vision and the knowledge and the understanding to know how to biblically react when you see chaos all around you. So, Heavenly Father, I want to praise you. I thank you for this Shabbat and for today and to be able to share these series of messages with your people. I pray that they've been a blessing to your people. Thank you for your presence here to open up the eyes and the ears and the hearts and the minds of your people. And now this word that has gone forth, I pray that you'll watch over it, guard it, protect it. It will not return to you void, but it will accomplish the thing that you purposed and sent it out to do. And so I pray, Heavenly Father, that this word will bring forth much fruit for your glory and the glory of your kingdom. And it's the name of Yeshua, the Messiah, that we pray, because he and he alone deserves all our praise, glory, and honor. So we give it all to him. In Yeshua's name, amen.